This is Central Coast Public Radio at KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. And coming up right now is Geek Speak for May 5th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool.
Welcome to Geek Speak, Bridging the Gap between Geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. It's nice to have the old theme back, isn't it, Miles?
Well, I guess. It
just sounds lazy to you, doesn't it?
It just seems like you didn't bring a cable.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe I should load up our actually newer themes in the system here at the station.
Or you can do what I do and just hold the laptop up to the mic and play music.
Or the humming thing, singing. I'm Lyle in the air, and with me is Miles Elam. We're going to take calls in the second half with questions and comments about technology. You can call us and ask us anything you'd like. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. So, Miles, what's up with the news today, sir?
New York City Department of Education has issued rules that teachers may not friend their students.
Wait, who made this rule?
New York Department of Education.
That makes sense. Okay, I like that.
Really?
Well, yeah, I like it because we're talking about probably 18 and younger, right?
Yes.
I'm fine with that. I mean, I think that the difficulty in making your Facebook account isolated to a specific area of your life is really hard. And even, you know, geeky people like us have difficulty sometimes parsing out the privacy features. And therefore, it's quite easy for my crazy Uncle Louie to submit something to my feed that's inappropriate for my students to see. And I don't really have a lot of control over that. I have to basically take on the responsibility of everyone I know to make sure that they're speaking in a way that would be appropriate for the fourth grade class that I'm a part of. And so I think that's really difficult. Now, I wish that we had a simple way of doing it, because I think it would be great for the students who are interacting a lot on Facebook, especially as they get, you know, into 13 set and higher, to have the ability to, you know, connect with their teachers. That totally makes sense. I like that idea. But I think it puts a lot of trouble in the space of the teacher to do the right thing, which they don't necessarily have control over.
Fair enough. However, there are no rules prohibiting text messages between.
Well, see, that's okay. I'm okay with that, because a student and a teacher should be able to text each other, should be able to call each other. I mean, why not, right? Why do you have a problem with about text messages?
Because I believe that this was brought up because...
Did they make the rules saying Facebook instead of like social media where other...
No, networking websites.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but the reason why this rule was put into place was because of numerous inappropriate relationships between students and teachers.
Oh.
And... text messaging is a lot
more
private.
Well, that's not the way to do it.
Social media, it seemed to me, to be much less of a threat in that
regard.
That's
interesting. Of course, my first assumption was that it was about the blurring of the lines, right? You don't really want your children to find out that their teacher is a dominatrix on the weekends, though that's totally appropriate for her to be, you know, have or him to be separated out their lifestyles like that. They specifically don't put stuff about their personal life that's not appropriate for their child, you know, their life. And I can't see doing that really easily with Facebook. But what you're saying is that the reason they're doing this is so that relationships won't happen? That's just stupid. Because relationships are going to happen regardless of what they will.
Yeah, to me, it seems Facebook is more out in the open. You can,
yeah.
A lot of people can have
much
better chance of seeing something going on. Whereas text messaging is... Yeah, the student gets the text message and then they delete it. And then there's, I mean, yes, if you get a court order, you could find the records of those SMS messages. But that's, if you already know that it's occurring, you don't need to do that.
Well, so in California and in many states, this isn't something that's ruled. I would suggest strongly that teachers, when they are thinking about connecting, and I'm sure they think about this already, that Facebook changes their policy sometimes, and it's hard to figure them out, and therefore you're inviting a real lot of complication if you include your students in your feeds.
Well, one of the things, and it's also behind the business model of Facebook, is that they're trying to push you toward a more post to everyone. Like, there's always that nudge push, to say, just make this for everyone. And you change the setting to everyone, for this one post, and then you forget, and then it
sticks.
There. Yeah.
Haven't logged in a while, and you log in, and then you're public again.
So that's an issue. At the same time, I think of that social media, I believe, does have a place in the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps this is just they don't want teachers using their personal accounts. They want there to be some...
Well, see, does Facebook allow you to have two different accounts? I think that's against policy.
Well, no, like you can make a page.
Right, that's true.
A page is dedicated. So, and it can be a private page. It's invite only.
Right.
So that's always a group that's totally viable.
In higher education, we're always dealing with this kind of thing. Like, where do we stand with these social medias? We're taking media. We're taking content. I'm a state employee at UCSC. And as I create anything that's around my job, it's actually the state that owns that work, right? I don't have a copyright relationship and such that I can create my own work related around my work. So I very carefully figure out, well, if I'm going to post something about work on my Facebook account, all of a sudden my Facebook stream partially is owned by the state. That's not really right. So that's something that I think about quite a bit. It's easier because I don't care about the content I'm posting. I don't care who actually owns it. It's, doesn't matter. But it is something to think about. And then as we ask students to participate, let's say in the grad program and a part of, the students are posting stuff about their work to the page that represents our program. There's this real strange thing. You can't really require them to do that because that's not really appropriate to say, hey, you're required to publicly post your work. That's something we don't do, right? Mm-hmm. But we encourage it because it promotes our program if their work is showing up on our feed. And of course, all of it's owned by Facebook in this weird way. So it's something we talk about quite a bit. And of course, the Digital Arts and Media program does talk about where that this topic is part of the dialogue in the program as well. Speaking of which, I'm kind of doing a segue here. Every year, for 7 years, we've been doing an MFA show, an art show on the program that I...
MFA?
Work. Master of Fine Arts. Thanks so much. It's a terminal degree, which means it's kind of equivalent to a PhD in the art world. And we do a show once a year. I'm always the technical person, unless I've broken my back, to kind of launch the show. And this year, I haven't broken my back, so I was responsible for launching it. And we opened last weekend and had the kind of bigger open yesterday, and it's going today and tomorrow. And it's some really amazing art. I was at the show all day yesterday and have been setting up for a week and a half. And I got to say, if you're interested in digital art, new media kind of work, and it's, of course, very hard to talk about what that kind of work is, but there's electronics, there's a projection, there's dialogues about how Google operates their identity filtering and how search results are changed based off of that. Really fascinating works. Mm-hmm. So if you want to take a look at it, it's running right now from 10 o'clock to 4, 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock today and also tomorrow, and tomorrow is Sunday the 6th. Unless, of course, you're listening to the podcast, in which case you're probably not in Santa Cruz area, so never mind. If you want to learn more, you can go to danum.ucsc.edu. And the reason I kind of talk about it
is that true? That most people who listen to the podcast aren't in the Santa Cruz area?
I don't have the figures of where they download from.
I don't know.
Well, I get the numbers from NPR on how much people download, but I don't know where they are. I assume that the people that do download, the major set of them is not local, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just a lot of Santa Cruz downloads the podcast. Probably not. It's a lot of numbers for a local download. So, but the work I do, if people are interested, that's where you find out kind of how what I do up at UCSC and learn about it. From geekspeak.org, we'll have the link up pretty
awesome.
Soon. Next story, sir?
Since I was talking about Facebook anyway, I guess I'll bring up another aspect of them. There has been a recent court case in the U.S. District Court of Eastern Virginia. Facebook likes have been found not to be speech protected by the First Amendment.
Wait. Okay.
The fact that you like something.
Okay, so what you're saying is, if I go and like something, like let's say there's new axes being sold at a hardware store, and I go, ooh, I like this this axe mm-hmm. on Facebook. That right there is not protected by free speech? Is that what you're saying?
The issue that came up was that you had one person who had some support for a person who worked in the sheriff's office.
Okay.
And then there was another person who was running against them, and they were taking a side by liking the other person's campaign page.
Okay, so two campaign pages for sheriff in a community, and one person's liking, that works in the office, likes the other campaign.
Right.
Okay, go on.
And got fired for it. And the thing is that they were saying,
that's my free
speech.
Was the
only thing that you knew about was the like, and you didn't know about any of the other things that they may have had, like a bumper sticker or something like that. And so is that a protected free speech that shouldn't be controlled by, or were they doing something untoward with a conflict of interest? And
well, of course they're doing something with a conflict. I mean, firing a person because of their personal beliefs.
No. That it was a question of whether or not liking something was a conflict of interest.
Interesting. Well, so the idea, but you're not just liking, you're publicly declaring your like. That's the conflict. Isn't it the public declaration of, was this person employed by the incumbent or something? Do you know the details of it?
I believe they may have been, yeah.
It's a better story if it is. So let's say that the incumbent sheriff has a deputy or something, and the deputy goes ahead and likes the Facebook page of the candidate that's running against the incumbent, and they get fired. If that's the only reason, of course that's not a fireable offense, right? That seems kind of ridiculous.
Well, they're talking about whether or not it would give them qualified immunity because they hadn't transgressed any really clear lines about what...
Except that they had. They'd publicly stated something.
Well, that's the thing, though, is...
It's also not publicly saying, I don't like the sheriff. You're publicly saying, I like something else. I mean,
but
you might like cheese, too.
But in addition to that, they were also saying that... the court was saying that it wasn't considered speech, that a like button isn't considered speech.
Oh.
Which, when you say a like, it's kind of a vague... It may have some vagaries there, but at the same time, there's a lot of Supreme Court precedent that says that expression is not limited to actual words.
Of course not. I mean, written words as well, but you're saying words in general. But isn't the idea of pushing the button like saying the word like, that is a word.
Right. But free speech is protected by us in our country.
Yes. What I'm saying is pushing...
Just saying something is different than giving material help toward.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The act of doing the like is actually more than
speaking.
Yeah,
we have a freedom of association in this country.
But,
so it's a... A like is basically I'm associating myself with this.
I get that. Should we move on?
Sure. And the Geek Speak
legal
fail.
If this was a phone call, I would have said goodbye at this point. So I want to bring up Java, because you're a Java programmer, right?
Yep.
Apple recently, you know, they in some releases, they fixed a security hole in their version of Java. They released their own version of Java that... was being taken advantage of, exploited by that Trojan that went around recently. So I won't get into details of that. You can listen to other shows if you'd like. But the point is that the other thing that Apple did with the Java is that they, if you don't use Java for a while on your machine, you're not using it somehow, they actually disable it. Mm-hmm. And then you get prompted to say, do you want to enable Java? And you say, yes. And then if you don't use it for a while, it'll get disabled again, which is a clever safety precaution. It is a true thing in security practices that the more stuff you have running that you aren't using, the more vulnerable you are, right? You really should close down everything possible that you're not using.
And many browsers have been taking this tact with Flash as well, that they'll detect if the Flash plugin is out of date and then notify you and say, yeah, you got to update this.
Right. Apple's new update is disabling Java, and it also says, you know what, if that's out of date, you can't even run it. You have to get it updated. We won't let you run Java that's not... which is kind of interesting for that OS to take that stance.
Well, Well, considering the amount of malware that's infected systems,
totally.
Mac systems now, that seems prudent. Also, bear in mind that Apple is no longer maintaining their port of Java.
They're not. How are they what are they doing?
Oracle is now
taking over that.
Yeah. So Oracle, who makes the most popular JVMs for Windows and
Java Virtual Machine, it's the thing that actually translates Java into bytecode. Go on.
Actually turns the bytecode into machine code.
That's good.
And
good
executes
point.
It. Actually, that's shit. But anyway, I couldn't get into it.
7 hours later, Java discussions.
But they now control Java. So if you want to have Java installed on your new OS X Lion, for example, you'd get it from Oracle.
Okay.
From Apple.
And Apple is then, if you don't use it for a while, disabling it, and it checks to see for you if it's newest.
I don't know if
it seems like it's a lot
but
of.
Apple did that through their system update. And I don't believe that the system update is going to be affecting now a third party install like Oracle's Java, which I'm actually kind of okay with just because. For a developer like myself, especially if you're doing server-side programming, Java is indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
I use it on a daily basis.
Right.
On the contrary, the typical user out there does not use Java anymore.
Right.
For a while, there were applets, and they got a bad name because you'd see the gray box on in the middle of your web page, and this all of a sudden your system would stop for 15 seconds, and then it would come back up again, and you find out all it was a bouncing animation. But
so, are you okay with Java not really being on the average client?
Yes, because most people didn't use it at all. All they saw was the orange box in the bottom right-hand corner that said, "Hey, you need to update me."
Right.
And then people were like, "God, I hate doing this over and over again." So they stopped updating, and then you end up with greater amounts of vulnerabilities, and it wasn't anything people were using.
Fair enough.
If you're going to use it, great. If not, and you're like the 99.9% of people who aren't going to use it, then please disable it, uninstall it.
Next story, sir.
There's a search engine out there that is trying to, you know, make its own mark, which is very difficult in the world of Googles and Bings and, you know, Wolf from Alpha and stuff like that. So what is special
about... Those are all search engines, by the way.
Yeah. So what is special about this one? This search engine, known as millionshort.com, it removes the top 1 million most popular sites from being indexed. And so the ones that you get are all going to be smaller players.
Oh, that's cool.
You end up with something that's, some say more community-oriented, so others say hipster search.
This isn't equivalent to going to Google, doing a search, and then going to the millionth page. This is get rid of the big players that might be talking about this completely, the top million websites.
Right. You would not get a search result for Google. You would not get a search result for Facebook. You would not get a search result
New
for
New York Times, any website that you and I would talk about.
Yeah. That's not necessarily everything we would talk about. There are a few sites out there that, you know, would be fine, but
geekspeak.org.
Yeah, geekspeak.org would totally pop up.
Awesome.
Oh, technically it would pop up on Google as well.
Who's eventually. What's the search engine called?
Millionshort.com.
This is cool. It looks nice.
But what some people have said is that it reminds them of the internet back in the 90s. Before you had good search engines, you had a search engine. You were able to find some stuff, but it wasn't that finely tuned setup that we have nowadays where you ask a question and you could misspell it or, you know, say, what is, you know, that show that has that guy that does this thing? And then he'll come up with that show and you're like, what? Oh, okay. This is going to be a lot more of the... hey, this is more community. This is going to be the smaller players. This is going to not necessarily show me the... I'm not doing research. I'm trying to find the exact item. You know,
right.
I'm not trying to find the definition to a word. I'm not trying to find, you know, what the homepage of a specific thing. You're trying to find a zeitgeist, if you will.
Their tagline is wonderful. So it's millionshort.com. Imagine a search engine that simply removed the top 1 million most popular websites from its index. What would you discover? That's the thing that's so appealing about it is it's not really about like, oh, that'd be useful for... It's more like, well, this would be an interesting way to look at the web.
Right. And also to put into context, you wouldn't see Wikipedia. You wouldn't see YouTube. And that's where a lot of people use Facebook. They go to Wikipedia. They look at YouTube. They go to Google for mail or news. And take all of those away. And most people wouldn't even know how to interact with the internet.
It's true.
And it does give a glimpse into what the internet used to be like. So, if, you know, for old timers like us, and ends up being, you know, nostalgic.
Okay, well, since you're talking about search engines, I'll go ahead and mention one I thought was really cool. One of the art programs, Jesse, did this wonderful piece that's at UCSC right now, which is, you know that Google produces, you can produce a Google profile, and as you search with that profile enabled, your search results actually modify, or the way you look at the web actually is collected and looked at by Google to determine things like what ads you see, but also what search results you get. And so if you're a certain type of person, which everybody is, then you will see a certain type of results based on the type of person you are. And this
is we're all individuals.
Yes, we're all individuals.
I'm not.
So what Jesse's done is taken and made four profiles, one in England, one in the South, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, and each of them have different likes and qualities. One was a expecting mother, listens to NPR from California. One's a conservative, religious reader of content from the South. One's a business guy on the East Coast, I think, and one's a young British man. He's interested in politics in England and sports. So those four profiles exist, and they continually crawl and look at things, and Google syncs of them from the IP addresses where they are, right? Mm-hmm. Using web proxies. And as they navigate the web in their areas of interest, Google keeps track of them somehow, and then algorithm looks at what they want and such. And then you can actually...
keep track of them because everyone seems to put Google Analytics at the bottom of their pages.
That's exactly right. And very specifically, those pages that have Google Analytics or Google Ads are the ones that these people read. Right, mm-hmm. These non-people. I'm trying to think of the...
pseudo-people? What?
So what you then do is you can do a search, and you'll do a search. All four of those users will search for you, and all of the pages of the 10 top results of each of their experiences will get pulled up and made an image, and you'll get a view of all four of them, right? So mm-hmm. the top result entry for each of them will be different, mm-hmm. and the set will be different partially. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gives you an idea that just it clarifies that what we see from Google is not some magic reality. It's very tailored to us.
It is not an objective reality.
No.
It is very much I want to see this type of thing, and so that's what I'm going to see. It ends up being a built-in confirmation bias, and something that some people are actually very worried about, very concerned about with regard to services such as this. And also, you know, in terms of commerce, how this would be affected, that Amazon, for example, is saying, you know, people like you, you know, people with your habits looked at this thing. You know?
The thing that's interesting about it also is that it is algorithmic generated, right? It's not like someone's going, oh, this person's from the South, so they're going to like this more. It's more like a whole bunch of people from this area that looked at these pages also looked at these pages. The idea behind it is very there's no brain
right.
thinking about it. There's
but it isn't
just
statistics. It isn't just geographical.
No,
they
no,
also
no.
find that it's also your political affiliation.
Absolutely.
Your religious background,
absolutely.
Things like that.
But the thing that's creepy about it is that we don't, as the algorithms
another
get...
Another thing that's creepy about it.
Another thing that's creepy about it. As the algorithms get more complex, we won't really understand how it's being done, how it does what it does. In fact, the only way to describe what it actually does is to read the code of the algorithm, right?
Right. I don't believe there actually is... Well, there may be one or two, but there are very few, if any, people that understand the entire algorithm.
Right.
There are pieces that are done by different people. Software projects like this are
so large. You're talking
about
Google's indexing system.
Yeah. Software projects like this are so large now, even for an individual company.
Doesn't one person know
the whole picture
exactly.
at any one time.
And the only way to really describe it would be to have a complete understanding of the code. No one can actually do that. So we don't know how Google is doing what it does. No one does.
Yeah. Yeah, you know the overview of and the yet, whole thing, and you know the specificity in
right.
your own.
And yet, even at a very light level, like the thing is that this piece of Jesse's is very. It's, by the way, everybodysgoogle.com if you want to try it. Everybodysgoogle.com. No apostrophe. And it's very clear that all it does is highlight that this is happening. You know, you can't actually take on the persona of that person and start looking at the web, because if you started doing that, you'd modify what that person would see, right? It's being updated all the time. Right. So you have to do it in such a way that, hello, this is happening. There's no solution, right? And, of course, we like that Google gives us what we're looking for. I personally like that. In fact, it's kind of frustrating when my own computer system doesn't work as well as Google, right? When I really want to search for an old email message, I go into my Google account and use the web interface. I don't use the local IMAP server.
Or if we're trying to find something on our website.
Right.
Go to Google.
Oh, yeah.
Site
I use Google all the time.
Goofy.org.
Absolutely. But they're tailoring everything for me, for what I will like. That's weird and creepy. You're listening
it's
to Geek
funny.
Speak.
It's funny. I don't consider it as creepy per se as... It's a recognition that we are not all the unique snowflakes that we like to think we are.
I'll go with creepy. You're listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can call us and ask us anything you'd like, or tell us anything you'd like about technology. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Miles, GeekBit.
People talk about, how do we reduce our fossil fuel usage?
How do we reduce?
Yeah, I mean, it's a common thing. And how do we get people not to blow up mountains to get the coal underneath it, or use all these fracking techniques that are found to have different, you know, environmental issues? So one thing, a possibility that's been brought up that I thought was a very clever idea, was if you don't like the use of fossil fuels, then buy up the reserves. Buy up the land that the reserves live on. That the reserves
okay.
sit on.
Okay.
And don't mine them.
That will increase the price of oil and decrease its use.
It will.
Effectively, right?
Well,
you're
the thing is,
you'll remove that from it, from
right.
the. Right.
If you really believe that you want to cut down on fossil fuel usage, then sequester the fossil fuels before they leave the ground.
Okay. Cool. So get out your wallets, everybody. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. We can take any questions regarding technology that you have to offer. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And already we have Jim from Santa Cruz.
Hi. I am using Final Cut Express. I presume that you're familiar with it.
I've heard of such a thing.
And, yeah, well, that's good. And, I have been having trouble with my saving of a clip that I have rendered. It runs at the moment that I have rendered it, but if I quit the program and then come back to it, everything I've rendered is unrendered.
Yeah, that's kind of actually a common thing.
Is it?
Yeah, you need to export it. What a video editing suite is doing as you edit and work on things, you don't actually modify the original files. You're actually creating a virtual file, if you will, of all those pieces. And it does that as you go so that you can preview it and you can see it. When you're actually ready to save it and make it a movie that anybody can watch, you'd actually export it as that new film. In doing that, all those things would get stitched together and saved. Now, it does the rendering on the fly so you can preview it and experience it. But that cache might not be something, and I call it a cache because it's something that you don't care about because you can recreate it all the time. And on the higher end apps, they actually the not the Express version, basically, you would be controlling that a little bit better. So once it's rendered, when you actually stitch, you don't re-render it. But in an application like that, when you start and stop it, it just allows the cache to be deleted, and that's actually a good thing because you're not creating extra storage problems for yourself.
Well, so how do I overcome it? I have to export it before I close down.
Definitely. You got to save it. Save the exported version. Sometimes
now,
it's called sharing.
I have to run from that exported version. I can't go back to the one I have on my hard drive.
So what you have on your computer right now is an edited version, which is really just the file itself is an instruction that says,
right.
take this original and this and cut this here and move
right.
this here and fade this.
PDL.
Yeah. And now that's a really good thing to save because then you can make changes to it. If
right.
you want other people to view it, or if you want to be able to open it up quickly, you want to then save that as the file format that's not calculate it as it goes. And you do that by doing a save.
Export save.
Good luck.
Well, I understand the new version of Final Cut. It renders when you're doing other things, so
sure.
You can play it right immediately.
Yeah, and you're also using Express, which is, you know, it's just a lot less, right? So they don't work on these sweet little extras.
Ah.
But the newer Final Cut, a lot of people have problems with it. It's mostly because it's a complete rewrite and it's not backwards compatible, and there's a lot of problems with it. So,
well, that's what I was wondering, because I was thinking about upgrading.
Yeah, you might have a lot of pain in upgrading from Final Cut.
Because I've been using a flip camera.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, your flip camera business, they went out of business.
Yeah,
right?
I know. it's not working well. But I'm wondering if that also... Well, I guess that's an MP4.
Yeah, that's not so important. In fact, that's a pretty nice standard format that will probably be playable for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Editing video. Very hard to do. Well, we're going to wait for calls. Miles, do you want to take another news story?
Sure.
The phone number is 1-800-655-5877 if you'd like to call in. Again, 1-800-655-5877.
So in a run toward the ubiquitous electric car that we're trying to go for, mm-hmm. Automakers, specifically Audi, BMW, Chrysler, Daimler, Ford, General Motors, Porsche, and Volkswagen, have all collaborated and standardized on a single universal charger for electric vehicles.
That's big. That's awesome.
So that, you know, you could go someplace. And apparently they're making it in such a way that charging an electric vehicle using this system would take as little as 15 to 20 minutes. Although I don't know that would be 100%. I'm thinking that's more along the lines of getting to the 80% mark, because that getting to 80% is very fast. And then that last 20%, which I'm sure you've come across if you have a laptop.
Right.
Charging it from
phone.
When it's dead, getting up to quite a ways is very easy.
Right.
And yet you had that you're at 90%, and yet it seems to take forever to get to charged.
The tricky thing, of course, well, we won't get into laptop batteries. Let's talk about this car thing. This is something that you mentioned a couple times on Geekspeak as a concern as electric vehicles. If you have, you know, 14 different ways to charge an electric vehicle and you have to have actual standard plug, it's really hard to go over and visit the in-laws with your electric car because they don't have the same type as you.
Right.
So there's these rules
about it. Or you'd have to plug into a, you know, home 220 jack, something like that, and you're ending up looking like a six-hour charging.
Right, right. It doesn't have the kind of current availability. Very cool. So they're going to standardize. Is this kind of everybody or enough?
It seems like it would be enough. Notable exceptions that I don't see here are Nissan and Toyota. So I'm curious about what their plans are. Nissan, who makes the Leaf, Toyota, who has the Prius, the plug-in Prius.
Right. And,
but at the same time,
if there's enough of them, then be a standard, right?
Right.
Cool. Well, we have a question from Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth, and you're calling from Aptos. What's your question?
I love the everybody's Google idea so much, because I always, I'm a professional psychic, and whenever I put Santa Cruz Psychic in, of course I get myself, and I wondered what other people get. But I'm curious if...
Don't you know that already?
Yeah. I know everything. Psychics, we know everything. But,
so you're talking about, so everybody's Google, which I just mentioned, Jesse Fulton's graduate piece.
So
really cool.
I'm kind of curious if you'll do an experiment. I just tried putting that in like 3 times, and... nothing happened. Like, I didn't get any results. And
now
it's telling me too many queries submitted.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if the site's not working or if it's...
No, so it does work, but to see what others see, I think you push the visualization up top.
You push what?
Okay, up on the top of the menu, there's a thing that says visualize.
Oh, you don't hit go or...
Well, you do go and you've submitted it to the search engine, and then it takes a while, so it gets added to a queue. And now, if you'll see the actual posts, if you click on visualize, you'll actually see
visualize.
The output. Right. Right now, puppies is being displayed.
I would never figure that out. Now
yeah.
I have a black screen, but...
It'll take a second to load. It's complicated.
Oh, it won't work on an iPad. Your graphics card does not support WebGL.
Oh, yeah. It won't work on an iPad.
Oh, interesting. thing.
The visualization.
Okay, okay,
but if you want to go to UCSC and just go on up to the show, it's posted on a big 70-inch screen.
Oh,
but,
I wanted to go to that show. I'm not sure I have time, but it sounds great.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, he's using WebGL, huh?
Yeah. Pretty cool, huh? Miles can see it because he's not on the radio compared to me. Everybody else can't see it. Ha,
and
ha.
What is WebGL?
Yeah, what is WebGL, Miles? That's great. That's a good question. WebGL is a with a web API for the graphics cards processing of 3D graphics and GL.
OpenGL actually is the,
yeah.
the spec. Yeah.
So I think Safari and Chrome and Firefox all allow support of it. I thought the iPad had OpenGL support.
Not yet.
That's annoying.
Desktop Safari does.
Yeah.
But mobile version does not yet.
This, I mean, what we're seeing in web development, since Miles and I met, we met as web developers, which is kind of cool. But we've seen the changeover. Quake, which is a game we used to play all the time, you can now completely do in the browser. You couldn't used to do that. That's amazing.
I had a problem running it on my computer sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And now it's just no problem, except for on the iPad. Apple. They probably want the battery life to be more than 4 minutes. Should we take another call?
Certainly.
Certainly. Ooh, I like that. From San Jose, Anne, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
Got a little problem with Yahoo email.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Yahoo email account, and it was hacked into about 24 hours ago, and somebody sent an email from supposedly me to my 490 contacts saying that I was in trouble and needed money.
This happened last. We got the same call last week, different person, same problem.
Oh my God!
Really? Yeah, yeah.
So where did they say you were this time? Because last time it was
Sierra Leone.
No, it was Philippines.
Okay. Where were you? Where were you traveling? You needed money.
Supposedly, I was in London. I lost my passport, et cetera, et cetera.
Have you ever been in London before?
Oh yeah, I've been to London.
Yeah, that's a classic one though. That's the original.
But the thing that's great is that both times it's been places where people have gone and been, so it's more reliable, more realistic. Okay, everybody, listen very carefully. Anne just got hit hard. Go change your password. Make your password longer, please, everyone. It's going to be kind of annoying, but it's worth it. And a good password, a really good password, is a long password. So think of something you like to do. We have a password show if you'd like to listen to it.
Yeah, we have a complete show dedicated to
the only way to find it on GeekSpeak Course is to use Google, and then Google might not give it to you.
Okay, but I also, when I went into my email, I lost all my contacts.
Yeah.
I lost all my email history. And now I can't call Yahoo because there's no way to call Yahoo to ask them to cancel my account or see if they can retrieve my contacts.
Okay, so they can't. They might be able to retrieve your contacts. That's interesting. You can submit a ticket for that. I'll get into that in a second.
How do I get hold of Yahoo?
Okay, there's two things you need to do first. Make sure you change your password on your account so that you take ownership. Also, go and look under the settings for where mail gets forwarded and make sure that it's not forwarding mail anywhere. Once you've done that, you can be pretty sure that your account is safe from those people getting back in. But when I say a good password, make it a good password. A good password shouldn't be something that's hard for you to memorize. It should be something that's long that people can't guess. That's the biggest trick, okay? The longer the better, in my opinion. And it shouldn't just be a whole bunch of nines, right? You should go ahead and use an eight in there or two. But like, you know, think of your family pet and say that, and think of your grandmother and say, my grandmother loved my family pet and use their actual names. No one's going to guess that because it's too long. It took too long to guess it. Okay. Anyway, now, what you need to do at this point is you go to the help area, the support area, and you should be able to submit a ticket to Yahoo. They won't respond to you, most likely. Right, Miles? Would you do that?
They are famous for not responding to you.
Good.
In that regard. There are just too many accounts out there. They don't have the staff for it, especially now after they had huge layoffs.
And they're not, of course, making much money on you as an individual. You're not the client. They're advertisers of the client. So, unfortunately, if you really want to get that email, the contract list back, that's going to be really hard for you.
Mm-hmm. How about just canceling my account? How do I do that?
I think in that same area, you can cancel your account.
Okay. So go into the help section.
Mm-hmm. I think the help area, the support area, it might be help, might be support. I'd have to step through, and I can't really do that while we're on air as easily as I would like. But canceling account is something they have to support. It doesn't mean that they'll delete your data. They might have your data. This is the real frustrating thing. Yahoo almost assuredly has a copy of your contact address book. You
right.
can't get it from them, and you can't make them delete it. Isn't
wow.
that great? Would you agree, Miles?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, that's not necessarily a bug. That's also a feature, because you don't want someone to be able to just arbitrarily delete your account underneath you, and you don't want someone yeah. outside on the net.
Except being that like, someone basically erased her account, making it, you know, she lost all her address books, right? So
yeah.
it's effectively erased, and Yahoo won't let you recover, maybe.
Right.
Now, of course, I don't know, because I'm not going through the full steps. If someone has a lot more familiarity with this and listening, please, please, please do contact us. And it's very common for our podcast listeners to have responses to this kind of thing. So make sure to listen to next week when I hang up with you, call back and give Rick your phone number or something so we can contact you if we do find a solution to this. Not your email address, of course, because you won't necessarily have one. Here's the thing that Miles and I have been kind of focusing on for a long time. This is a perfect example. You know, your contact address was in the cloud. It was safe. Yay. But since you're not really a serious customer, there's no human being ever interacting with you. It's a system. It's a collection of algorithms that decides your worth and your value to Yahoo. And they don't have the time and energy for you. Even though it's in the cloud, it means nothing because someone deletes it. What if you had deleted it accidentally, right? This was even malicious. You no longer have that data. So it doesn't matter that Yahoo has 50 copies of it, probably more. Because it's not accessible to you anymore. So Miles and I are, I won't speak for Miles, but he'll just go, mm-hmm, in a second. I believe very strongly you need to make sure you have local copies of the content that's really important to you, even mm-hmm. if you duplicate it in the cloud. What was that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you so
Can
much.
I ask another question?
Yeah, Anne,
go
for
it. One more question. The guy that hacked into my account, or the person that hacked into my account, does he have access to all my content?
Here's the wonderful thing. It's not really a person that logged into your account. It's a program that someone wrote that logged into your account.
Okay.
And yes, they have all your contact addresses.
Wow. Okay.
Because what they're doing now is they're trying to log into all those people's accounts and get all their addresses.
Oh my God.
And this is not happening with a person behind it. This is happening with a program behind it. This is why it is so essential to have strong passwords. Because the programs can, over time, get into the account. What they're going to do is they're going to check 7,000 Yahoo addresses every hour, and they're going to try, four addresses.
The top 200
passwords on every one of them, and then they'll do it again. And more than that, the computers that are running the code that did this to you is someone's home computer that's not aware it's happening. Anybody creaped out yet?
Yeah, I'm getting freaked out. Okay,
yeah,
I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, so the real trick behind this to get not creeped out is to know that there are applications out there that are actually really stupid, that are doing kind of creepy, horrible things. And the way to make sure that you're not hit by them is to get above the average user's level of protection, right? So most people have short, easy-to-access and crack passwords. As long as yours is long enough, you won't be the person that gets hit again. Unfortunately. So tell your family and friends to make your passwords long, right? Because the pain and hell that you just went through, they don't have to go through. Thank you, Anne. Good luck.
Okay, have a good day, guys.
And do check back with us in case we have a solution that's a little better than what we just gave you, because we might. It might be a Yahoo employee says, I can help Anne. So talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and don't use password as your password. Don't use secret as your password.
Don't use swear words. Don't use any 123456.
Yeah, because that's the same one I have on my luggage.
Was that Blazing Saddles?
No, that was Spaceballs.
Spaceballs. Okay, good, good. Okay, so what would we have luggage to lock them? Right, sorry. We're not going to go into passwords? We're not going to talk more about passwords? I love talking about passwords.
We could, but don't we have another call?
Yeah, we do. Should we take it?
Yeah.
All right. From SoCal, Stuart, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
I've got a question. I had recently purchased an iPhone and downloaded some music and synced it up to iTunes, and somehow I deleted all my my music files off my computer. And so I do have most of them on an old iPod Nano 2.
I'm stuck with that. Deleted them from iTunes wouldn't have deleted the music. You might not be able to play some of that music because it's a different.
I can't see it anymore. So the library somehow has vanished off my laptop.
Okay. Have you done like a search for music on your laptop?
Yeah.
Okay. We won't get into that problem because you have an iPad Nano. Go on.
And so the question is, how do you actually transfer from or export from an iPod Nano back into a laptop?
It's time to hack.
Time to hack, okay.
Yep. Apple doesn't really want you to do this.
The short answer is you can't. The long answer is...
There are
a couple different ways of doing it. You can have a Linux machine where you connect up that iPod Nano to
and mount it and then move them over.
Yeah.
There's got to be a simple way to do this without...
There are utilities out there to...
Yeah, but can you trust the utility? Because it's not legal.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I mean, it is legal. It's not strongly supported by the industry.
Yeah. Because they don't want you sharing it.
Yeah, it's really to stop piracy, right? So if I had an iPod Nano and I go over to my grandma's house and she's like, I love that song. I was sweet.
Right.
Here you go.
Here it is.
Right. Yeah. They don't want to make it easy like that.
Was it all MP3s that you downloaded or was it items that you purchased on the...
That was actually all my old CDs that I downloaded. I mean, I copied.
You ripped your CDs and put them on there.
Yeah, so I actually have the CDs. It's just, I don't want to spend hours going through them all again.
Well, there are, just searching recover music from iPod. I get 3 ads in Google that say there's things that there. And then there's some guides. Oh, guides, Mac Rumors. That's cool. So there's a couple. I'll link to a guide. That's probably the best way to do it in the sense that, there's a whole ranking and such of how to do this. You are going to have to learn how to do it to some degree.
Right. So the other question, and I haven't checked into this. I periodically, maybe once a month, back up my laptop.
Oh, you know what? Actually, this is not that hard to do. This is really cool. When you connect your iPod, assuming this still works, you're on a Macintosh environment?
No, it's a PC.
Okay, it's a little different. Run. Because the suggestion here is to just, it mounts it as a volume, and you can actually rsync it off the volume. Uh-huh. From terminal. I'm saying that to Miles more than anything else.
Yeah.
On a Windows, it does have that? On a Windows, it does have a way to do it. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to post this this link to geekspeak.org. It'll be up in about, I don't know. 10 minutes or so, 20 minutes.
Okay, so let me ask the second part of the question, which is, so I have a separate portable hard drive that I, as I said, about once a month back up my laptop. Is there a way, I haven't even looked in that for fear of opening that to see whether that would, I could selectively reinstall the music that was backed up on that, or does it reinstall everything?
Now what, you're using Time Machine? No, you're not using Time Machine. What are you using?
It's just a 300 gig portable hard drive.
Yeah, what software are you using?
Oh, it's through Windows.
Right.
That's what
okay.
I evolved it to.
I think that when you start doing the recover, it'll show you what's in the system, and you can do checkboxes.
Okay.
And I think you can do that pretty easily, and safely.
That would be the easiest because that would have everything on.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. I mean, I would go that route before moving forward. Definitely.
Okay.
I hate that the idea that you updating iTunes and changing something erase the content. That's really not very cool.
Well, I don't know if it had to do with auto syncing, which I don't normally do, and somehow it took.
Right.
It just replaced because I had recently downloaded a few items.
Mm-hmm.
And put it on there, and then replaced every. That's the only thing that's showing up on there.
Well, Stuart, good luck. I think the LaunchNet, you will be able to see it before you commit to it. So
okay,
all right, and it should warn you if the backup utility, recovery utility, is going to erase anything. It should warn you prior to that.
Should do that.
And if it doesn't, and you lose more data, please do call back next week.
Yeah, and ask for somebody else.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Kick me off the show, okay? Thanks,
all right,
Stuart. Take care. We probably have time for one. We have no more calls pending, so we probably have time for one more news story. Lots of times, Miles, we don't get to all the stories you've got, so I'm assuming you have more awesomeness.
As a matter of fact, I don't.
Keep in mind, everyone, Miles has no more awesomeness.
I am awesomeness free.
All right, can I rag on about Java more? The point I was going to make about Java was that we're seeing it being disabled and such, but you've done a lot of code in Java. I mean, do you think it's going to be around forever anyway? Or do you think that it's going to phase out and just everyone will stop using it? The server-side Java is really strong. There's a lot of development going on.
Yeah, server-side Java is not going anywhere.
The thing that I don't understand about server-side Java is that one of the big reasons for Java is that if you write a Java app, it runs in any environment, right? There's an interpreter for Mac and Windows and Linux. So you've got this great flexibility of flow of application code. But in a server environment, you're always running Linux anyway, so who cares?
On the contrary.
There
are people who do run it on Windows servers. There are people who do run it on a Solaris box. There are people who run it on standard, you know, Linux machines. There are people who run it on BSD. There are people who run it on Mac OS X servers.
I get that, but my point is, when you've got a server environment, I mean, isn't it also true that lots of other things work in that environment? Like, is Java just a lot faster and better than these scripting languages like PHP or Ruby or Perl for, you know, interpreted languages?
It's not just that, it's also the libraries involved. So
there's so much infrastructure,
Java EE,
if you will.
For example, servlets,
yeah.
Messaging service, Java Mail.
And all of that stuff being accessible the same way in every environment is really important.
Right. You could use Tomcat, you could use GlassFish, you could use all these different application servers, and they all have essentially the same API.
Awesome. Okay.
Application programming interface, the same way to interact with it.
That's a very fancy way of saying that. I love it. This is GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, though I don't think his show is named that anymore. It's by David Lawrence, and he's cool. He's a nice guy. Lets us use the title and all that. GeekSpeak on KOSP is here every week. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Everything that Miles and I talk about and that we add more information about up at geekspeak.org. So if you followed a story but didn't get the URL, if you didn't really know that it was everybody's Google and you want to look it up, that's where you go. Everything we post and talk about, we post up on geekspeak.org. And I've been getting it up pretty fairly recently. Rick is here this week, and thanks so much, Rick, for answering the phones. We always appreciate getting calls from you. You can, of course, contact us throughout the week if you'd like. You can email us, and one of us, most likely Ben, will get back to you. Have you noticed how Ben has been getting back to everybody? It's kind of awesome. but I always read all the email that comes in as well. For KOSP and for GeekSpeak, my name is Lyle Troxell. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week. And if I haven't said it enough, go to geekspeak.org. Talk to you soon.